This episode is sponsored by Apollo, a tool that's helping me to open doors and close deals faster. Wanted to share it with you. Apollo is a complete end-to-end sales platform, letting you email, dial, connect on social, build plays, and schedule meetings. With conversational intelligence transcribing my calls lately and reminding me to act on my next steps to drive deals across the finish line, it's been a lifesaver. It's no wonder Apollo is the most loved sales tool on the planet. Thousands of users rank Apollo as a top tool on G2. Start today completely free and see how Jesse and I use Apollo. Sign up in the show notes below or at thesalesplayers.com/Apollo. That's thesalesplayers.com/APOLLO to start your free trial.
If you do any prospecting with LinkedIn, you have got to go get set up with Surf. That's Surfe. It's a tool you can use to add new contacts to your CRM system directly from LinkedIn in seconds. I'm using it every single day. I add contacts, follow my deals, keep track of notes, and it ends up saving me a bunch of time on prospecting and outreach, which means I can spend more time moving my deals along. The data is always 100% accurate since I don't have to copy and paste all the fields over from each and every contact that I want to put in my CRM. Instead, Surf does that all automatically with just one click in about 60 seconds. The team over at Surf has put together a very special offer for fans of Sales Players. There's a link down in the show notes and you can use the promo code JWSURF5. Don't forget the E at the end of Surf. That's JWSURF5 for 5% off your first year. Don't spend another minute doing things manually. Go get set up with Surf. Hey, what's up, sales players? In this episode, Chase and I are speaking with Lloyd Lobo. Lloyd is a serial tech entrepreneur. He's the co-founder of Boast and the author of the book From Grassroots to Greatness, 13 Rules to Build Iconic Brands with Community-Led Growth. This was a great conversation, and we took it in a whole bunch of different directions. Lloyd started out by sharing some of his background in entrepreneurship, doing sales, how he built his companies. We talk a lot about the power of building a community and how that can help you build an iconic brand by using this community-led growth concept. We get a little bit into startup equity and finance, which is a topic that I've wanted to talk more about on the show. He talks to us about what it's like living in Dubai and shares a whole bunch of great tips for building a fantastic company. So with all that said, we're excited to introduce Lloyd. All right. And we are live. Lloyd. And it's pronounced Lloyd, right?
Yeah. You got it.
Lloyd. It was Lloyd.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure.
My mom threw an E in there. There's a freaking whole story about it I can make fun of. She was hoping that, like, you know, if I started a company and named it my name, I wouldn't be able to trademark traditional, like, English name. So she threw an E in there. I'm like, wow, E stands for entrepreneur. She like willed it into existence.
She knew what was going to happen, you know?
She willed it.
That's a great story. That's a great story. I love that. Well, welcome to the show. Chase and I were talking a little bit offline. We first want to dive into your story a little bit. Tell our listeners how you got started in the business world, what you've built, and any stories that you can share from along that journey.
Definitely. So I often say I'm an accidental entrepreneur. I was just a rebellious kid, man. And I think a lot of people say this, that the guys with the A's and B's are working for the guys with the C's and D's. I didn't finish high school. Yeah. Okay. And I didn't finish high school. And most kids who wouldn't finish high school wouldn't apply to university. I applied to every freaking college, university out there. And I get calls from a couple of universities, colleges, asking to write entrance tests. This was in Canada. And I wrote them and I did well. It's just, I wasn't a bad student. I just didn't believe in the system, right? And they asked me, like, hey, what's going on with your transcripts? And I said, they're coming. I was born in Kuwait and I had moved to Canada from Kuwait. And I said, yeah, there's political unrest in my country. So I don't know. It'll be on the way. They're like, your entrance tests were really good. So you can start, but if in a month you don't have the transcripts, you're going to have to unenroll. And luck would have it, they never followed up, man. And I graduated with a bachelor's of engineering in software without a high school diploma. And the lesson one here for everyone in sales and marketing, anyone that's in IC today, is luck and risk are two sides of the same coin. The ones that get lucky are the ones that never stop flipping. Risk, 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 risk. It's going to be really, really hard, but pick a lane and stick with it, like, and just don't stop, right? When you're starting out, you got to acquire skills and get really, really good at skills. And the more you do it, nothing will improve you more than just doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it. And you just get better and better. And then you add more skills and then you become more well-rounded. So I finished engineering and I didn't want a 9-to-5 job. I just didn't want to do this.
Yeah.
Right. And I asked a bunch of entrepreneurs that, hey, what's the best skill I could learn if I want to be an entrepreneur someday? And they all told me, man, you got to learn to sell. You got to learn to communicate. It's like, you know, you kind of suck. And if you want to, like, I mean, in a very polite way, but that was the net. You're going to have to sell and learn everything from convincing your wife that you're going to take this entrepreneurial route and bring no money, to convincing customers that I have barely a working product, to convincing early employees to take the job on low pay, to convincing investors. Everything you do, by the way, in life is selling. Think about it. I mean, if you have partners, if you have anything going on, it's all selling, man. I didn't realize this. But I took it to heart and I said, you know what?
Yeah.
I'm not a very self-motivated individual. Like most people aren't, okay? Self-motivation is not sitting on the beach somewhere and showing up when the conditions are perfect. Self-motivation is, do I show up when I'm repeatedly punched in the face? Most people don't. And I said to myself, if I took a public speaking class, the first time five people laughed me off stage, I would never, ever show up. So what I started doing to improve my communication skills was I started to think, like, hey, what could I do? I said, why don't I just find a job that forces me to communicate day in, day out? So I started applying to sales jobs. And nobody would give an awkward engineer a sales job. Now, luck. I throw luck a lot there. And luck happens when you keep putting yourself out there. Luck would have it was a startup founder doing a telecom startup, needed cold callers. And he didn't care what my background was or anything. He's like, okay, you want to do cold calling? Here's a job for you. So my first job was cold calling for a startup. Okay. And I kept picking up the phone and pounding it. And the first call I made, I took 4 hours to practice. And then when the DM showed up, I hung up and everyone started laughing, but they motivated me to move on, right? Because we're all in the same boat. And so this is the thing. It's like you keep showing up and you keep pounding the phones and you keep making the calls. And what happens is you pivot on the fly. You improve your message because you know, you learn to survive and then eventually thrive, right? You try to, like, you know, you read a lot of stuff, right? But I'm not a big reader. I'm not going to read a book end to end. But what does a job that, you know, you got to keep slamming the phones force you to do is like, you read things just in time. And back then, like, books were huge, right? All this content wasn't there as much on the internet. But I just searched, like, how do I improve this? Or how do I do that other thing? And I read the book How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie a couple times. And
great book.
And I read the book Spin Selling by Neil Rackham. My favorite book today, till today, because I used it to build products as well. That whole questioning form of asking situation questions, then problem questions, and implication questions, and need payoff. Later, I'll talk about how I use that framework to actually build products and get to product market fit. But I was just applying it. And then my messaging got better. And with more and more hundreds of calls under the belt, I started to build better relationships and understand the customer and understood where they're coming from versus saying, buy my shit to understand their pain points, understand, like, research the customer. So when you call them and you have like seconds with the DM, when you get to the connect, what are the things you need to say? Like, can you reference some immediate thing that happened within the company? Can you build rapport very quickly? It's like dating, man. You don't go to a bar and see a woman and say, can I marry you or can I take you home tonight? What do you optimize for? If you're a sensible person, you optimize for the phone number And then when you optimize for the phone number, what do you optimize for? For the text back and the text back and the next date. Selling is like that. You get a DM on the phone. Don't freaking have verbal diarrhea. No sensible person is even going to buy a $5. Maybe they'll buy a $5, $10 product off the phone. But even in the day of the internet today, they likely won't. They're going to research it. So your goal is to optimize for the conversation that will lead you to the next meeting, the next step in the process.
Next steps.
And so that's what you need to pique. Pique their interest. Like say something that they weren't expecting. Pique their interest and get the next meeting with them. So a lot of people weren't doing that. And I learned to do that. And my next job then, my girlfriend then, now wife, got into med school in New Jersey. So I moved there. I wanted to be with her. And of course, everything I am and I have, I was able to do three startups and fail before both did well, was because she had a stable job as a physician. So
that helps.
It helps a lot. And so so I started applying to jobs in New Jersey. And I say luck a lot. No stable company would hire an engineer turned cold caller, but another startup founder did, right? He gave me a job as an AE. I joined there as an AE, hoping like pay went a little better, went from like $20,000 to like $50,000. I joined as an AE. And I show up and I realize, man, there was no established sales process or anything like that. So now I got to go to customer sites. And these are now larger customers. Great, better experience, of course, right? Like went from phone calling to now larger customers walking their sites like Tiffany, Armani, Simon & Schuster, figuring out their pain points, working on multi-hundred thousand deals. And then translating those pain points into product requirements because I had to wireframe them and write the requirements for the dev team. And then I understand that they don't have any marketing too. So guess what? Build the sales materials, build the marketing side. Great experience, man. Best experience ever. It's like almost like being a founder. But back in the day, being a founder was what? Founder was what? In the age of before the AWS. Was people from enterprises raise a bunch of money and they hire people for all these roles. But I had the best founder skills. And then from there, I worked my way up to running sales and then eventually, or rather running sales and marketing. And after four jobs working at a startup, when my best friend from university, Alex Popa, he called me with a startup idea he had. I immediately jumped at the opportunity because think about it. That was all I knew. I only worked for startup founders. And I'm like, if I'm going to make no money working for guys that are going to eventually run out of money, by the way, none of them worked out, I may as well bet on myself. Right.
Yeah.
And so that was a quick, quick journey. But I want to summarize like for the ICs out there, four things that I think were invaluable to me eventually being able to live life on my own terms. Number one is communication is everything, right? If you want to get anywhere, you need to be able to communicate. Without communication, you don't have an audience. You have an empty room. So that's your first C. Number two is your companions, your community matters the most. If I didn't repeatedly work for entrepreneurs and didn't have that circle, it would be very hard for me to go and start a company. I had seen it day in, day out. That was my community. That were my companions. Who you surround yourself with can make you feel like a rock star or destroy your mental health. So you want to be the best salesperson, start building a circle. And that's a combination of content and that's a combination of the people you hang out with. Like surround yourself with the best salespeople. You'll learn by osmosis. The third is creation. Whether you're creating content or playbooks or art or products, you're creating stuff, creating relationships. Learn to create something, right? Because the more you create, like if you're in sales for a specific skill, start creating content. I think it's complete bullshit. Companies that dissuade their employees from going out there and creating content and generating influence. In 2024, if you dissuade your employees or rather make it difficult for them to create their own influence, eventually you'll be paying for other influencers. And that 10 to 100,000 category micro influencers is the fastest growing. So build your own, create your content. Yeah. The more you speak with authority, like, you know, now you've combined communication with creation and you keep doing it on a cadence. And that's my last point, is consistency, right? From Mr. Beast to Warren Buffett, without this fourth C, you have nothing, is consistency. They never stop, right? So communication, creation, your community, and consistency. If you combine these four, you can have everything. And a lot of young kids, mm-hmm. I see, even with my kids, right? They want this instant gratification, because we're in this world yeah. where you search for something and it appears. But skills are not something that happens tomorrow, right? Like, there's nothing. Like, if you want to, most things there's a cheat code for. But right. for skills, you know, the unfortunate thing, as much as you can try all the cheat codes, is you got to throw in time, man, especially in sales.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to go back to something you said a minute ago, which was, it piqued my interest, because this is a point I was just making to a colleague of mine. So I was telling him a story about how a few years ago I was working for a venture-backed company in the Bay Area, and I happened to share a taxi with the CEO of that company, which was a really cool experience for me at the time. And we were riding back to the hotel after an event. And so I kind of had her for about 15 or 20 minutes to ask whatever questions. This is a super successful CEO. She ended up later selling her company after taking it public, and a bunch of other, you know, a bunch of other cool outcomes. And she said something really interesting to me, because I was asking her what her favorite business books were of all time. And she goes, careful not to fall down the trap of just reading books for the sake of reading books. Read a book that you can implement in the next 6 months. And you said something similar, which was, as you were coming up and learning these skills, the right books landed in front of you at the right time, and you were able to action those books. Can you tell us a little bit about how, if someone's starting 2024 with a book list or in a book club, and they're reading a bunch of the top, you know, spin selling, or How to Win Friends and Influence People, how can they quickly read that book and implement what's in that book? How did you do that, I guess, is the question.
You know, I made a post on Instagram. I stopped LinkedIn for the last couple of months for a variety of reasons. I was getting spammed a lot. So I said, let me experiment with Instagram, because it's more personal, more visual. And I made a post, which got a lot of views, on don't get guilted by people who brag about how many books they read. Take action on your goals, show up consistently, and yeah. aim to do a little better every day. In business, in the gym, forcing yourself to do difficult things is the only way to grow. Now, the thing is, this was easier for me to do, because I had a reading disability, and it was very hard for me. I wrote a best-selling book, but I've had to force myself to do this. I had a reading disability. I've never read any book cover to cover. So I think the only book I've read cover to cover outside of my book is How to Win Friends and Influence People, also because it's a very small book conveyed with stories, and that's what I try to do in my book. Neil Rackham's book and every other book I've listened on long drives to customer sites. And what I realized, so I had this problem to begin with. I was like, because I hated reading, I would procrastinate for tests and everything. So one key thing is recognizing your limitations. So I knew that. So I would just research things that would give me the superpower I needed immediately. It's not even 6 months. It's like, I need it like right now. So I have a sales call coming up. How do I do the best discovery? Oh, I was like searching the internet. A bunch of people recommended Neil Rackham's book. So it's like questioning framework. What is the summary of the questioning framework? Okay, can you go deeper? What are the examples? That's how I think about everything, right? Because as an entrepreneur, as an IC, as an exec, as a human being, mm-hmm. your time on earth is limited. Mm-hmm. And I realize this now that I'm 43. Your biggest leverage is time. It's not things, right? So I'm like, how do I create more time in my day that I can slam more phones? If I read a book cover to cover, and I pride myself on reading a book cover to cover every 2 days, that takes me away from I don't know how many sales calls. But I can make more sales calls, so what am I optimizing for? I want to optimize for making more sales calls. So what is the thing that is going to make each sales call productive? It's preparation. Okay, now maybe I'm new and there are some nuances to preparing for those calls or conducting the call. So I'm going to research. And if it's a freaking discovery call or a demo, I'm going to research how to do the best damn discovery call or a demo. I'm not going to research how to do a freaking closing call and to deal with multiple stakeholders. I don't need that right now. I'm going to optimize for what it is. And honestly, this was a, you have to put yourself in this mindset. Fortunately, I was already in this mindset because I hated reading, or rather I just had a reading disorder. So for me, everything in life I do is just in time. Mm-hmm. And it works.
Yeah, just
it works,
in time.
It works for me. I don't know if it works for other people. I would find it hard pressed to believe that it wouldn't work for you. So my philosophy in life is do things just in time so you create more time for yourself to do the things that bring you joy. Why? Like, you know, I don't enjoy reading. I enjoy working out or playing with my kids or going to the beach. So I'm like, you know what? I'd rather do that, right? If reading brings you joy, do it by all means.
Yeah. Well, Lloyd, let me step in here. And man, I've done some research on you, and it's amazing where you've come from to where you're at today. And coming from, I think it was it Kuwait that you're from, and just being going in a war zone to Canada to a entrepreneur, you know, I call myself a recovering entrepreneur turned SaaS sales executive, because, you know, I tried the D2C game after COVID. I had a business for about 10 years. COVID happened and took us from $60,000 a month in revenue to zero overnight. And really put a lot of things in perspective. But one thing that I'm learning from you is just continue to show up, and that grit and that grind. And one thing I'm looking at on your website, it shows, you know, if you build a community, you won't become a commodity. I would love to learn more about what you mean by that, and really how we can gain value in building a community.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I quickly realized is the power of people, right? And if you build a community, you won't become a commodity, is back to this thing of yesterday's innovation and technology always becomes tomorrow's commodity. Think about it, right? We've now seen the last 20 years. We don't say dot-com company or web 2.0 company or social company or mobile company. We won't be saying AI company anymore. Right? Yesterday's innovation always becomes tomorrow's commodity. But if you look at the biggest successes from, you know, the most obscure ideas that eventually became iconic, global, sustainable phenomena, from Christ to CrossFit, they all were built on power of communities, right? People doing business with people. And you look at OpenAI. I mean, see, my company, Boast, was an AI company. We had access to OpenAI probably, I think, in early 2020. Before ChatGPT was a thing. But if you look at OpenAI, it was built on the power of people, companies like us giving, helping them out. And when Sam Altman was asked to step down as CEO, the community also revolted, right? Like, that is the power of community. You look at HubSpot, you look at Nike, you look at Apple. What do they have in common? It's community. And so as I was, you know, the reason why I wrote this book on community was because we were able to bootstrap our company, Boast, through the power of community. When we got to 10 million ARR, we had no marketing team. We were less than 30 people. And even the growth equity firm that bought half the company came through a community event we hosted during the pandemic. So everything I have, I live in Dubai now, most of the 80% of the time. Almost everyone I know is through that community. Some of our biggest customers, I think the largest deal I closed, which generates like almost 3 million a year, also came through that community. So it's given me a lot. And that is nothing other than, you know, you bring together a group of people with a common goal, a common purpose, and then you help them without expecting anything in return. So if I break this down, like I said, from Christ to CrossFit, every obscure idea that eventually became a global enduring phenomena went through the exact same four stages. Number one is people listen to you or buy your product or service. You have an audience. I talk, you listen. Most influencers have an audience. You may have some rumblings of a community, but it's an audience when predominantly it's one to many. Now, when you bring that audience together to communicate with one another, to interact with one another on a cadence, it becomes a community. Like Saster is a community. SaaS Talk is a community. That sort of thing. Now, the kicker or how it gets bigger is when that community comes together to create impact towards a purpose that's beyond your profit, right? Towards a greater purpose, it becomes a movement. Like Harley-Davidson almost went bankrupt in the 80s. What was the innovation in the 80s? It was electronics. The Japanese manufacturers commoditized electronics. These bikes became cheaper than Harley. Harley almost went bankrupt. The Harley leadership said, let's build the company around the ethos of community, not a marketing strategy. It's a company strategy. Leaders went out there and started writers' clubs. It had direct oversight from the president. Writers became employees. Employees became writers. Then they created movements to donate to larger causes. And today, Harley is an iconic brand, $7 billion plus valuation. If a dog wears a leather jacket, you're like, oh, well, that's a Harley dog. People tattoo their brand, right?
Right.
So it's built on that ethos. So when your community comes together to create impact towards a purpose that's beyond your profit, it becomes a movement. And the last one is when the movement has undying faith in its purpose through sustained rituals, over time, it becomes a cult or a religion. So think about that. Audience, first you build an audience, you bring them together on a cadence, it becomes a community. Community creates impact towards a purpose repeatedly, it becomes a movement. And then through sustained rituals over time, it becomes a cult or a religion. So you can look at Apple has their rituals, Tesla has their rituals, Nike has their rituals, and now these are all cult-like brands. And the reason why I wanted to talk about this is, all my life, I was surrounded by community. Okay, so my parents are from India. They were piss poor, not educated, so they couldn't afford to go to the West. They moved to Kuwait because of the currency translates very favorably. And so they worked there. My mom never worked. My dad worked. He's a self-educated chef and became a very celebrated chef by the time he retired. But nonetheless, they were poor and they couldn't afford to take us on holidays anywhere. So we'd just keep going back to India. And my mom lived in the slums of Mumbai, her parents with 9 siblings. And when I would visit my childhood summers to the slums of Mumbai, it was my fondest childhood memory because it was a communal vibe. Eating food was communal. Mm-hmm. You would pump water every morning. It's communal. There's no restroom in the house. So you'd go to the toilet, which is you're standing in line. It's communal. People play together in the summers. It would rain and puddles would turn into ponds and we'd be swimming. And that was a communal activity. Then I experienced the Gulf War. Security lapsed and the country was completely overtaken. What I saw was every building became a sub-community. Somebody comes down our building, like, we have a problem. Yes, we have a problem. Let's come together and solve it. Somebody says, hey, I'll guard the building from X to Y time. And somebody else is like, hey, I'll organize food supplies. And somebody else is like, if you've got displaced family members, I'll give them shelter in my house. And every building became a sub-community that communicated with the next building and the next building that communicated with embassies and governments and evacuated us to safety. Then I moved to Canada and after I graduated, only worked for startups and became a part of the startup community, Startup Grind, Startup Weekend, started our own community, Traction, and then Bootstrap Boast. And the only time, like, so all my life I had no money and I was very happy because I was surrounded by people. When we sold half the company and I left the day-to-day and transitioned, I actually got depressed, became drunk, became overweight. And as I started to reflect, this was because I lost my tribe. I literally felt I lost my tribe. And I started to research more and I found this concept of blue zones, the 5 places around the world where people live functionally until 100, right? Functionally 100%. Is important because most of us, we retire, we burn out giving it to the tax system, right? Like mortgage, property tax, income tax, federal and state, long hours, we burn out by 65. And then we're like, okay, now let's just make time for the things we really want to do, but you can't do half the things. And you die at 78.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so these people live functionally till 100. And I think 4 or 5 out of their 9 traits have to do with communal activity, like hanging out together, eating together, socializing, working out, walking.
Yeah.
And so that clicked. I mean, I wanted to write a book and I'm like, hey, this gives me a great purpose. Writing about communities. And then I started to research and I found a very common theme across like hundreds of companies, talking to thousands of people, like audience, community, movement, religion. Like you look at Atlassian, right? You look at Notion. Like look at some of the greatest SaaS companies that have sustained growth over time. It's people to people, right? Technology always evolves. So that's why I say if you build a community, you won't become a commodity. Because think about it. We're in the SaaS world with AI. Every SaaS tool that needs to be built has been built or can be built. So what differentiates? Mm. What is your biggest moat? You can't go around saying, oh, I had the freaking patent on this. Come sue me. In 2024, sue me.
Yeah.
Like who's going to go through a lawsuit unless it's a big company? And if even if it's
right.
even if it's a massive company and the incumbent has stood up a freaking server in like, I don't know, Bahamas or somewhere, or in like the Cayman Islands, and has put mm-hmm. up with literally no contact information, a SaaS tool, and is getting growth like crazy for like a tenth of your price, what are you going to do? Nothing. Your biggest moat is your customers, your community of customers that spread you word of mouth, that help you with validation, with customer success and everything. So that's what I talk about a lot. And it's not an audience, because your audience is just listening to you and passively consuming. A community is when they actually come together towards a bigger purpose.
Yeah. I think that this is an especially hot topic for us, Chase and I, because we're trying to build a community around this show and the other media we're putting out. And we realize that we have to go far beyond just people tuning into us. We want people to rally around something. And so we're working on, we have a Slack community right now that's growing nicely. But yeah, that's exactly what we realize, is that you've got to have people doing something, taking action and rallying around something. I love the one-liner, Christ to CrossFit. I'm going to use that because that is so good. But yeah, I think you're exactly right, that some of the best brands of our time, that's exactly what they did. People line up to buy the next iPhone every time it comes out. You know, people who use Atlassian are meeting up and doing all kinds of things together, and they're learning together and those kind of things. So these are the brands that have killed it and will continue to kill it going forward.
Yeah. So it's important you rally them, right? So you got a good cadence here. Maybe you're posting something daily, right? Just make a commitment. Maybe the podcast is weekly. Now you've got maybe Slack conversations happening. What matters is when you bring the community together, can the founder step away and is interactions happening? So find that one 10x problem that you can solve for your community, and then bring them together to interact with one another, and just be a facilitator, not a satellite parent. And I, as much as this gets hate, I love the idea of in person. And I'm not saying do in person every day or every week.
Yeah.
But can you do monthly meetups? Can you have volunteers or ambassadors from your community do meetups in their cities, which strengthens the bond, right? So right now we're sound in sight. Anytime you incorporate more than two senses, you start to build stronger connections. If we were doing this in a bar, chances are we're there 3, 4, 5 hours now, because it's taste, touch, smell. We're talking about personal stuff. And that's how these bonds get strengthened. And so you have the online content. The problem is everyone is doing online content. And I say this often as well, is when the world goes buffet, you got to go Michelin star. Everyone wants to do digital, right?
I'm so glad you said
Michelin star.
So here I come. Because one of our goals is to get more in person. We're not quite sure how that looks yet, and it's so weird in this post pandemic world where it's like, okay, where do we all meet up? And we've got a global fan base for the show, which is really awesome and exciting. So where's the central point where we can get everyone together? But I like the ideas you're saying of, is there a localized, can there be a Austin and a New York chapter of fans of the show?
Find your super fans. Where the most engaged, right? And then give your super fans the soapbox so they can be leaders. Because you know what? If you have a chapter lead and give them some budget or some authority and autonomy, they're going to go screaming from the rooftops. If you micromanage them and be like, don't stretch the logo like this, or you said that, they're going to be like, screw you. They're doing things for you, right? They're furthering your brand. So help them build their brand and their network, because that's what people want. They want to feel loved and important and connected, and find those people who can put in the time, and you know, it's a win-win. They'll build your community. They'll have a little bit of budget, and they'll do it on a cadence. And then you can bring all the chapters together, you know, as it scales, once a year or once every 6 months. I actually also like the idea of smaller, especially like they say, right? Like in the startup world, in the beginning, do things that don't scale. It's very easy to make it perfect for 5, 10, 20 people than to make it perfect for hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Lloyd, one of the things I'll share with you, I had just sunsetted Life Bar, my company, and I was talking to my Shopify rep, and she suggested me to look into SaaS sales. And I was like, what the fuck is SaaS sales? I don't know what that is. And she's like, yeah, I think you'd be great in SaaS sales. And so I looked up on Audible or whatever podcast, SaaS sales, and then Jesse popped up. And so that was 2 years ago, and that's how I met this guy. And I've just stayed in touch with him. I booked a call with him, and now I'm co-hosting the show. He's asked me to co-host the show. We've consulted on some things, and it's all through community, you know, and he's providing value. And it's, I think really what you're saying is provide value. Just keep giving, 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 just like Alex Ramosi talks about. It's like you got to provide more, 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 and then you can take, but you got to continue to provide that value.
And you know when the time is to ask. You're not doing charity. So we bootstrapped the company on the power of community. We had salespeople, but our salespeople were more like community managers in the sense we'd ask them, what else can I connect you with? And then when people come to our events, we ask them, hey, how are you solving this problem? And they may say, oh, we're not. And we're like, would you be open to taking a look at how we do it? And they're like, yes, you guys are great people. Or we're with this competitor, would you be open to listening to our pitch? They're not going to say no when they keep coming to your events. I think in the first year, we did like 100 events, right? And they weren't large events. They were small meetups. So what happened was in 2012, when we started, one thing was certain. There was no like LinkedIn wasn't a thing for content distribution, and there was no TikTok and Insta and all of that for business, right? And right. Podcasting wasn't huge for B2B startups anyway. Startup market was just nascent at the time, and all the content out there was provided by popular bloggers. And I said, if we start blogging, I don't think it's going to take us years. So I reached out to the local newspaper and asked them, convinced them through some hustle to give me a column on the newspaper, which I myself, you know, a lot of people don't do this, but they'll put stuff out there and hope it gets traffic. But I actually wanted a weekly column. So I got all my friends to like, share, retweet, and drove it so much traffic, which convinced the editor to turn it into a weekly column. And I showed up and wrote it rain or shine 3 years. And when I stopped, that column stopped. But nonetheless, I wrote that. And then I put a link in there saying, if you want to be featured, it was called Startup of the Week in the Canadian newspaper. And if you want to be featured, apply. And then everyone that applied, we would invite to a weekly meetup at our co-working space. And one day, 200 people showed up to the meetup or something like that, 190 or 200. And they said, you can't do this anymore. And that evolved into a bigger conference eventually. And we've had CEOs of Uber and Atlassian and so on, and Twilio come to our conferences. But you keep doing it. You never stop. And opportunity creates itself when you put yourself out there. And so I have this philosophy that, and it's like fall in love with your customer and make them successful beyond your product or service. And know when the time is right to ask. If you keep giving, 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 you'll get. And you can, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I can't keep giving, giving, giving. I need to get right now. Fine, if you host a meetup for 10, 20 people, that is your right ideal customer profile. I'm sure that'll lead to a few connections, and you know it'll cost you some pizza and a little bit of space. Or you do a live webinar. It's just easier in person, I feel sometimes. But you do a few live webinars and you keep doing it. Now a lot of people are like, "Oh, who's gonna show up?" Freaking, I'll tell you who show up. If you figure out your ideal customer profile, you're maniacal about who that is and the pain they have, and create a webinar or a meetup specifically for them, right, that targets them. Then you cold email outreach that whole list. You may have like 200. I guarantee you'll get 10 people to show. That's what I did. The reason why I really literally started social in a way in the last year or so. We weren't big on social because it, we needed the instant gratification at the time, meaning I needed people's emails and phone numbers. And at the time, social wasn't the best way to collect people's emails and phone numbers, right? They're just passively consuming your content. And you don't even know if they're your ICP or not. It's a lot harder to like go on TikTok or Instagram and build your ICP to tune in than saying, I'm going to host a webinar or an in-person meetup and then just cold email a bunch of people. So you got to do what works like, you know, fastest way possible sometimes.
Yeah.
And so that's what we did. And we amassed a huge email list, and that was our audience, like 120,000 email subscribers eventually, what it is right now.
Wow.
Lloyd, I want to ask you something also that I don't think gets talked about a lot, but did you do any affiliate marketing? Did you have any affiliate like partnerships with other brands that made you look bigger that you could bring into deals to be like, hey, you know, people are coming into our audience. Can we do some sort of affiliate deal with them?
So, creating
partnerships.
This affiliate concept at a high level, right? Like there's lots of terms, partnerships, referrals,
channels,
yeah. All this stuff. But I mean, you boil things down to the lowest common denominator. What it is you're getting the brand rub of somebody that's a bigger brand than you. And I love that concept of brand rub. And how do you figure that out? First is be maniacal about your ICP, right? Who they are, where does your ICP eat, breathe, drink, sleep? What are their pains and goals? Pains and goals are now immediate and may help you with product one or two, but also figure out their aspirations, which may give you multiple products and what stands in their way. Now that you have the ICP, figure out, like, create an Excel sheet or whatever, spreadsheet, Notion doc, and put three columns. Who do they fund? Meaning, what are the tools and services they pay for? That gives you a list of people you could partner with. Who do they follow? Meaning, these are the influencers they listen to. And where do they frequent? What platforms, what blogs, what magazines they read? Make these lists and then invite these people on your podcast to partner with and whatnot. So what ends up happening now is without even giving somebody an affiliate commission, because in the early days, they're like, I don't even know your freaking product. I don't want to sell it. How can you convince somebody? But imagine this, you got 52 weeks in a year. If every week you have a webinar that now, see, you've done one Zoom webinar that's live with people tuning in, and maybe in the first 4 or 5 months, you have to cold email people to tune in. That is fine. You may have to cold email people until you build a list. But now what happens is they're on Jesse's webinar and they're listening to the CEO of Twilio. He's not getting an affiliate commission, but he's agreed to be on your show because it helps his brand, and his brand rub helps you in a bigger way, right? And so that's what you want to think about, is like, they're all, for me, in some way or the other, affiliates, right? They may not be taking, and it's less contrived. When somebody says, oh, you know, here's a link, people know they're getting paid. But when it's the CEO of a big company that's a guest on your show, they're not getting paid, right? And so when you keep doing that, you got to just figure out who has more reach than you, associate with them, add value to them, them add value to you. People see that, and then you go higher and higher and get the brand rub of the people. In the first beginnings of Boast, and when we were doing these events, we had local entrepreneurs who were like maybe 10 million, 20 million ARR, maybe Max sold a company for 20, 30 million. And over time, that changed into 100 million, into billions, right? And you just keep leveling up from there. And over time, people are like, man, these guys may be a small company, but they hang out with like the coolest people on the planet as relevant to the startup world. To me, coolest people on the planet as relevant to me. I am your ICP. Why wouldn't I do business with them? And I think that is really important, is before you have something that's affiliatable for commission, leverage the brand rub by just bartering.
Love that.
You're bringing me, you know, I'm from Kentucky, and I used to own a valet company. So we would do stuff for the Kentucky Derby and all these private events. And it was always amazing to see, this was where the biggest deals were going down, at these private events, at the Kentucky Derby, at, you know, Keeneland, at wherever. It seemed like two big groups were meeting, and this was where they were having fun, and it was a palatable situation, and you're just spot on. And I want to get back to more person-to-person meetings.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, think about it this way. Every marketing channel, let's call it all ways to communicate with your customer. When it's cool, it gets oversaturated. And you got to do something different. When the whole world is doing things one way, you got to explore, what can I do that's a little different? Because it's all, you know, with time and technology, people are just inundated with more information, with more noise. You're driving down a highway at maybe 75, 80 miles an hour. What's the one billboard that hits you in the face and gets you to slow down? So when you get home, it's memorable. You got to be that.
Yeah.
You got to be that, and you got to do things that stand out. If, like, you know, I wear this hat, I'm like, you know, it's now on hundreds of podcasts and everything else. I've become recognizable as a function of me wearing it to every conference and every venue. I didn't want to be just another guy wearing, you know, like a khaki pants and shirt. I speak at conferences like this, right? And I wear a leather jacket and show up, and I'm like, you know, I look different. Now, whatever it is, I'm not saying just do something that makes you stand out. If you blend in, you're just like everyone else, right? For better or worse. And then if you combine that tactic of doing things that stand out with providing immense value, you'll be great. Look at Alex Hormozi. He came out of nowhere in the last year and a half, 2 years, right? I think he started hitting my feet in a big way at the beginning of 2023, probably ended 2022. Yeah. And he stands out, right? Like, I mean, is this jack dude talking about business, looks like your personal trainer is talking about business, and it starts to make sense, business and life. And it starts to make sense, right? I mean, he wears like flip-flops and shorts and like vest. Like, do things that stand. Look at Mr. Beast, right? One of the top influencers on the planet. You can't keep doing things because everyone's doing it. Don't build society's definition of success. That's the easiest way to be status quo.
Wow. That. I got a question for you. Actually, because we have a lot of listeners who are earlier on in their tech career, this is shifting gears, by the way, but you seem like someone who could answer some questions around equity and startup finance and some of those things. A lot of times members in our community will reach out to us and ask, help me understand my stock options, or help me understand how companies raise capital and how they use it and what the VC world consists of. And I know a lot about it just from my own research, but I wouldn't call myself an expert. I've never personally gone out and raised funding. I haven't personally sold a business. Chase has a leg up on me there. But tell us, maybe if you could summarize like your top three learnings working in the startup and SaaS and sales world, what are some things that listeners can maybe take home and think about as it relates to their ownership in their current company? Or if they decide to go out and start a company, what they should consider as far as, you know, bootstrapping versus raising capital, and maybe some pitfalls too. I know that was a really broad question, but if you could summarize just a couple of learnings that you found over the years in relation to finance in the startup world.
Yeah, you know, I've only ever worked at startups. So I'll tell you the employee's perspective. Yeah. Most startups make it so confusing. They give you options. They don't explain what the options is. I think startups need to do better on over-communicating what the options are, how big of the pool is, what value it is that you own, and how will that grow over time. And most people don't even know when you need to exercise it. Like, you know, usually within a couple months of you leaving, if you don't exercise it, it'll be gone. So you need to make that, you need to make that transparent to employees. And most employees don't know this. And then the tax implications, like imagine you exercise it and you exercise your stock options in the last 2 years when the pandemic value is high, then you hit with a fat tax bill. So I think, you know, number one, the key things to know is when you're taking a job, ask them what percentages, what you're giving me these options, what percent of the company does this represent? Number one, right? Like they give you like a freaking 100,000 shares or like, I don't know, some obscene number, 20,000, 7,500. Rather than you know, have saying that, oh, I have this number that represents, I don't know what, it's vague. Ask them, what percentage does this represent? And what is the value of this as it stands today? And then, you know, understand one, when was their last round of funding and what value was it and how it's going to grow over time, right? And then ask them, you know, if it's preferred, if it's common, it's obviously going to be common. All employee stocks are common stocks.
Common.
That, so that means that the investors will have preferred, and in any liquidity event, they get the money first. But nonetheless, understand what your liquidity options are. And it is not bad to seek advice on your options from an accountant that is specialized in this startup finance, because what you need to understand is, how do I brace myself for any obscene tax implications if I decide to quit and exercise my options? And if the tax, like, think about it this way, if you got hit by a tax bill for $100,000 because you quit this job and now you've accumulated, but you don't have $100,000 sitting in liquid cash. A lot of ICs don't.
Right.
What do you do? What do you do in that situation? So you need to seek accounting help, like tax help, basically, like a tax lawyer or a tax accountant that specializes in this. So how you defer those taxes, right? Because most companies, I don't know why, they don't educate you on this. So they give you—
No, not at all.
They give you a vague number of options, and then they don't tell you, you know, they keep it vague on the strike price. They don't beat it down your head because they give you this fat ass doc. I don't read documents. Yeah. 99% of the people don't read the legalese. When somebody dumps legalese in front of me, right, without a summary of the top 10 things FAQ I need to know, I immediately think that there's no trust between us. You basically are hoping that I don't exercise this, that goes back into the option pool to maximize for the founders. So what you want to do is, one, what percent of the company does this options represent, right? Number one. Number two, what is the value of it, current value? What was the company valued at the last funding round and how this has grown? And how many months do I have? What is the strike price, meaning how much can I buy it for? And if I leave or whenever, and how much time do I have to exercise these if I quit my job? And then the tax implications. And like, ask them straight away, do you have a tax accountant that I can get advice on tax implications? You should ask. And like, you know, if you ever speak to the founder or the HR person and they are knowledgeable, saying, you know what, you have like X months or weeks to exercise these options, but you're going to hit with a tax bill if our growth rates keep up. And let's say you leave in 4 years and you're fully vested, you're going to be hit with a tax bill like this. But you know what?
Yeah.
Here's how you would optimize it or defer it. Man, I want to work for that company. Mm-hmm. A company that makes everything transparent for its employees, knows the value of employees and its people, and clear, transparent communication. So it tells you two things. They care about the people, right? Mm-hmm. And it's all user experience, ultimately. Think about it, right? We're all in the world of user experience. Anything that has a very difficult user experience, they don't care about its users. Your employees are your biggest users, in the sense of customers, right? If you treat your employees with love, they'll treat your business with love and your business will grow.
Yeah. It's really frustrating because most people I know that have learned a lot about equity and, you know, strike prices and stock options and liquidity and all that, it's mostly from failure. They've been at a startup where, man, I do know people who have vested and then the company's share price went to zero after the liquidity event, or at least the common share price went to zero and they were out of pocket the AMT tax. So in some cases, that's them writing a big check to the IRS for something that's worth nothing, right? So it's cool to have your perspective on it. Just it's obviously, you know what you're talking about. And so I'm always really glad to share with listeners, because again, we get a lot of questions about, you know, how should I be thinking about, and everybody wants to build equity and ownership in something. And I think everybody should. And I think you're exactly right that the companies that are going to be transparent about that, and they're going to not hold back And unfortunately, there's a lot of them out there that will hold back, or they'll, you know, they'll write your offer letter without including the fair market value or the strike price or the, you know, outstanding shares that have been issued and those kind of things, or what the dilution rate was for the last round of funding. So it's cool to hear your perspective. And I think you're dead on with just, you know, ask for that information and make sure you get that. And if the company's not forthcoming about that, that could be a pretty big red flag.
If a company is not forthcoming in terms of their stock options, for me, it's an immediate, there's either they can't communicate or it's just hard to trust.
Yeah.
Well, I got one question and then we got to wrap up. But
yeah,
why Dubai? You know, I'm hearing a lot, Lloyd, like why Dubai? And then if we ever see you at a bar, what is your drink of choice, my friend? I always like to know what your drink of choice is.
You know, that's an easy one. The first one, I stopped drinking after I came to Dubai. And it's funny because Dubai is considered like Vegas meets Miami on steroids. And it's a land of party and debauchery, if you will. But I stopped drinking for health reasons, because after we sold a majority in the company, I almost died of COVID. Life lost its meaning for me. And I realized, man, I ran. I chased. And I neglected the thing that is most important, my health, my family. And I said, you know, I'm going to focus on something else. And so if you go to my Instagram, Lloyd Lobo, you'll see a pinned post on what I look like as an entrepreneur living in Silicon Valley and what I look like right now living in Dubai. My life's more centered around fitness. So that's an easy one. I'm 43. So, you know, I think what alcohol, as an entrepreneur, I'm an extreme person. I don't know how to do anything in moderation. So if I drink, I need to get wasted. And this was like a repeated occurrence in my life. And sometimes, like I said, with like with reading, you got to know your limitations. I know I can't just have like a couple of drinks. I know I got to get blasted and plastered. And so I stopped.
So now, what's your smoothie of choice?
I only drink water. I haven't drank.
Only water. All right. Okay.
Do you go electrolytes or anything like that in it? Lemon or anything?
Yeah,
no.
Sometimes straight water. You know, electrolytes is fine. Sparkling is fine, but mostly water is what I've been drinking. I don't know whether that works or not, but it does good for me. Through a bad lifestyle of entrepreneur's lifestyle, I accumulated a lot of gut debt, GI debt, and so I think water makes life easy, man. So anything to for longevity and good health. Why Dubai? So I'll tell you, I got three kids. My wife's an ER physician. I was an entrepreneur. Why do couples fight in the US or anywhere in the world? Because of chores.
Money.
Chores
too.
Yeah. Chores. 99% of the time is chores. You got three kids. Who's going to drive? Who's going to pick? I got working. I'm going to make all this shit. Dubai takes away chores from your life. Number one. Right? Like doing chores is not a thing here. Like people don't do grocery shopping. Having a nanny, having a cook, having somebody drive you around is incorporated in the, it's like living on a resort, number one. Even if you're middle class, you can afford to have a nanny. So all the things that we used to fight about is just immediately gone. Right? So that's one. Number two is extremely safe. Like I've left and lost my wallet. My parents who visited me from Canada, they have it, always gets delivered. It's safe. My kids can walk at night anywhere. And like my youngest is 2. Wow. My oldest is 10. It's extremely safe. 3, it's a land of positivity. Now, it's like Disneyland for adults, man. Nobody discusses bad news, negative energy. It's not a part of the thing. Like I feel like a lot of the times you get on a call and it's like, left wing, right wing, wokeism, cancel culture. We discuss all kinds of bullshit every day. And here, like you don't go to Disneyland or a resort in Hawaii to discuss bad news. The compound interest, think about it this way, right? Like your life of an entrepreneur in the US is what?
Yeah.
For 90% of the people. You can't afford to live in the city. So once you have kids, you move to the burbs. You're commuting an hour minimum one way. So 2 hours. You're leaving early. You're coming back late. You're working minimum 50, 60, 70 hours if you're in sales or any customer facing, any or high tech startup. You're working long, crazy hours. And then if you have kids, You got to pick, drop them, manage their food, come back, make meals, catch up on email. So what happens when you live this life? You basically are prioritizing everything that takes time from your longevity and your well-being, relationships, mental health, right? And so you don't have the time to eat, right? So you put crap in your body, right? You eat fast food. You consume sugary drinks to give you energy. You start listening, like there's so much frustration in the air and people are just motivated by discussing bad news. And if you think about it, the conversations around bad news perpetuates and festers and turns into bigger monsters, right? Like gossip. So you indulge in all of this and like you realize that working out is a chore. Eating clean is a chore. Between mortgage, property tax, federal and state income tax, you've foregone 60% of what you make. You have just enough energy as a married couple to have one nice dinner a weekend. Sunday, I still have Sunday PTSD, spending the Costco line, right?
And I was there yesterday.
And planning for the rest of the week. So you, and then maybe you do 1-2 weeks of vacation, Cabo or wherever, all-inclusive, eating the all-inclusive processed food crap in your body. And the compound interest on that over time is what I felt is like I almost died of COVID. And I'm like, all the money in the world, like I just went from having no money to having millions, but now I'm like potentially going to die here of COVID. What does this anything matter? So I started to realize your biggest leverage, because when you're a kid, you want that Lambo or that Beamer, you want the big house and all of this stuff. And then you realize at some point it clicks that what creates happiness is more time in your day. So now when I wake up, everything is done for me. I don't know who makes my bed. The clothes are clean. Like, I mean, I know who makes my bed. The clothes are kept. There's breakfast. My kids are driven. So as a function of this, what happens? I can eat clean. I can go to the gym. And that's what I'm saying. Go to my Instagram, Lloyd Lobo, and you'll see my pinned post. I've gotten fitter. I've dropped to nearly 10% body fat. My daughter is five, and I went to a father-daughter dance practice that we're having this weekend. And she was literally bragging to her friends that my dad has a six-pack. And I never expected that in my life. I'm 43. and her friend asked her mom, like, what's a six-pack? And her mom started laughing. She's like, Amelia says her dad has a six-pack. And she's like, what, mommy, what's a six-pack? So, you know, I think my wife and I spend more time together than we ever did. So think about it this way. The American dream is very difficult for 95% of the people. The 1-5% of the people that make it have understood the value of freedom and time. Freedom is success is freedom to do what you want, where you want, with whom you want, when you want. Because we invest so much in consumerism, buying things, buying that big house. A house is just a way for a bank to sell you a loan. So now you got to work 30 years to pay it off, right? Since I moved here, we have so much time in our day. My wife and I have been dating since high school. I was her prom date. And then once we started working and kids happened and mortgage happened, we were at each other's throats, right? I mean, like we just lost this last 15 years. Now we're here. It's like we're dating again. We train together. We eat together. Every meal is together. I'm like, man, it's like dating again. We decided we live on the beach and Dubai is a 20-minute city. So you can commute any one end to the other in 20 minutes. But we live on the beach as a function of living on the beach. Even if I want a bottle of water, I got to walk somewhere. If I want infinite restaurants, facilities, yoga, whatever it is, you walk to things. Now people will say, oh, you had an exit so you can talk like this, but you know what? You don't need to have an exit to think like this. Like you can prioritize the things. So I'll give you an example. Ignore the vacations and the things, right? Live in the city, live smaller. As a function of living in the city, you'll be closer to work. You'll be forced to walk. If you can walk 5-10,000 steps every day, it's hard to say, oh, I'm going to walk 10,000 steps. But if you're going to walk to work, you're gonna walk to work.
You just bake it in.
You just bake it in. right? As a function of not commuting an hour, 2 hours a day, you have more time so you can work out, you can meal prep, right? And this is one thing my wife made us do in the early days when she was a resident and I had no money. When we had our first kid, she forced us to get a nanny, and that nanny costs nearly like, nanny costs is almost what
cost. Yeah, it's salary. Yeah, I mean,
40-50K for a half time. And I kept arguing and fighting. I'm like, how are we going to afford this? She's like, nobody, trust me, we will not make it to the first vacation we take. You're an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm a doctor. Yeah. I'm bringing the stable income, but I'm an ER doc and I need to work these hours. So either you get a stable job to pay for it, or we invest in the nanny and we'll come up with the way to pay for it. But otherwise, you can't do your business and I can't do my job, right? The 2 week vacation is not going to save the marriage. And that was, as I reflect back, that was the most valuable investment, because I know now. Now, see, help in Dubai is very inexpensive. The reason why it's inexpensive is because people come from Sri Lanka and India, where there's currency arbitrage, right? The currency is significantly higher. And and now people will be like, oh, you're paying them less. No, I'm not paying them less. I'm paying them relative to their country. What minimum wage worker in the US can say they save $1,000 or $1,500 a month? Here, everything is saving because we house them, we pay for their food, and still we're not significantly out of pocket. Like a full-time nanny will cost you $1,000 to $1,500 max, and they will go above and beyond and they'll treat you like family, and and it's not transactional, right? And so if you spend like maybe on a driver half-time or full-time and a housemaid that looks after your kids and cooks, that improves your quality of life. Mm-hmm. That is the way things are done here. Now, people will bash me and I'll tell them straight away back. Is like, look at your minimum wage worker in the US. How much money do they save?
Yeah.
In California, they're resorting to living out of their cars. Here, they have accommodation, they have food, and they send every penny they make back home. And as a function, they can buy a home back home. Their kids are educated and whatnot. So like, I think we gotta explore places where people think about work and life differently. Do things, prioritize joy in your life. And I think it took me almost dying to go on this discovery. Otherwise, I wouldn't have.
Mm. This episode was not sponsored by Dubai, but I love it. We're going to try to get Dubai to sponsor this,
We just might. I'm definitely sold. I it wasn't necessarily on my bucket list, but now I'm like, I at least got to go check it out. It sounds really awesome. So,
my founder, Alex Becker, I work for Hyros, and he just got engaged in Dubai, and he was dropping a bunch of different photos there. And I mean, I've been talking to a lot of customers that are in Dubai. I mean, it sounds awesome.
A lot of people quiet moved here. I mean, the thing is this, I could have moved anywhere. I could have moved to Bali, for example, or Thailand. The check boxes are one, you want a predominantly like Western education for your kids if they're young. If we were empty nesters, we could have moved to Bali, for example. Mm-hmm. Two, it needs to be extremely safe. And three, given how young we are, we still want to have some mental connection back to the West, right? So this is the perfect, feels like East meets West balance. I think Dubai is going to be the hub of one of the key hubs of the future anyway. And the pace at which it moves, probably a conversation for another time, but Dubai, I feel, is run like a startup. In many senses, run like a tech company, a singular leader with a singular vision rallied around a set of values. And that's why government services are very easy. I wanted to get a license and change my car registration when I moved from Philly to when I moved from California to Texas. We briefly were thinking of moving, and it took me two trips. Here, I went to the office. They scanned my face, and literally, I have the visa. My picture and everything is tied to it. They didn't have to take another picture. They didn't have to fill another form. They saw my American license. They printed the Dubai license. Like, every service is quite easy here. There are no cops on the road because there's cameras. Mm. Now, one will say, oh, they're prying on your safety. Well, if you have cops disrupting, like, when there are incessant amount of cops at every nook and cranny, it tells me only one thing. This place is not safe. I leave my door. In the last 2 years that I've been here, I hate saying this because maybe somebody will barge in. But we don't leave, like most people don't leave their doors locked, right? The other thing I'll tell you, I have traveled around the world, almost every country imaginable other than Australia. Every place, airport that I've been to is littered with human signboards. You know what human signboards are? Basically, at every step of the way, there are people asking for your passport and boarding pass or some nonsense. You come into Dubai, I kid you not, there's a fast pass. And this is the true nexus. Literally, you show up, it scans your face, the gate opens, nobody asks you any questions, and you're into the country. You're into the country. If you've been there once and you've gone through immigration, you don't have to stand in that line a second time. And that line is faster anyway. In the US, I feel like the nexus line or the global entry line now is actually become worse than the regular.
Longer than the regular one. It totally is. That just happened recently. Well, the clear line was as long as the TSA line was longer than the just regular check-in line, which was nuts. That's really cool to hear. That sounds awesome.
To me, it's a city from the future. It's extremely clean. It's safe. And it's a very communal vibe. Like people are friendly wherever you go. And so I like it. So ultimately, you know, I'll go back to this. If you want to measure somebody's happiness, level of happiness, just look at their energy when they talk and see what they see, how their health has transformed. And I think those were the two biggest changes for me. Nobody asked me when are you going to do the next startup or what do you do for work? And I'm telling you, like there's countries around the world where people don't anchor on what your life doesn't mean what you do for work. It's a conversation point, but it's not the whole conversation.
I really think, Lloyd, this is very important for you to share. And so many people don't talk about this your wife was extremely smart to suggest having a nanny when she first had the baby. And having that quality of life is something that I think a lot of entrepreneurs and people going into entrepreneurship don't think about. And it's not all about burning out. And it's like, really, my goal is to have quality of life and to really live and to be present and have fun but have connection and not have to be like, oh yeah, I have a Lamborghini and I have all this shit, but I'm able to, you know, live life. And I love hearing that and seeing that. So
you know,
thank you.
Thank you, man. Like, and you know, I wasn't always like this. It literally took me, it's so freaking funny, man. Because I chased, did multiple startups, only ever worked at startups. And when the deal happened, my wife would be like, oh, you know, you don't spend any time with us. I said, listen, I'm going to book everyone to Bora Bora, which is our dream vacation. And the funny thing is we never end up going on that Bora Bora trip. But I'll tell you, I said, I will book everyone to Bora Bora, parents, sister, everyone, when the deal goes through. The deal goes through. We booked everyone to Bora Bora. 2 days before the Bora Bora trip, I'm hospitalized with COVID during Omicron. Oh, my wife, who's a physician at Stanford, is not allowed to see me. They have a 24/7 Zoom. They have people coming in spacesuits, and I'm like delirious. And then I realized, man, and my wife would always tell me, nobody cares. Your kids are not going to remember the Bora Bora trip. What they're going to remember is all those dinners you missed with them, right? And so now I just want to be present. And so then I'm like, you know what? Let's say I wasn't an entrepreneur in this outcome, but I'd be like, now I can work anywhere. So where could I work and how could I prioritize my life, which enables me to do the best work I can do, but my 24 hours a day are not owned by my employer. So let me do the best work I can do, which is focused on driving an outcome. And the outcome can't be a moving target. And then let me prioritize other things like, you know, like let me focus on fitness. Let me focus on family time. And then you start looking at costs of living. And then you're like, oh, you know what? I can live here or there or the other place where all these services that give me more time in my day and optimize my mental capacity for peak productivity is not maybe here. Maybe it's somewhere else. Yeah. Or maybe it's here and I've figured out a hack. So I think that is really important. And for me, it was... Yeah. I never thought that way until I realized if I go today, literally every penny here is of no use to me. And not only is every penny of no use to me, but my kids also won't remember the father they lost. Mm. So I left no legacy for anybody. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Lloyd, this has been an amazing conversation. Super insightful. I learned a ton myself. Tell our listeners where they can connect with you directly. And then if there's anything that you're working on right now that you want to plug for folks to check out, let's hear about it.
Definitely. If you want to read about community, get my book, From Grassroots to Greatness. It's on fromgrassrootstogreatness.com or LLOYED, LloydLobo.com. It became a Wall Street Journal bestseller within a week of launch. And I'm on Instagram these days, like sharing life and business for people in their 30s and 40s looking to live intentionally, focus on optimizing the saying that life and business is a marathon. It's not a sprint. If you sprint a marathon, you'll die. So I talk about a lot about like the journey of it all, right? And if you try to sprint a marathon, you will burn out. It's very important to love the process. Building anything successful is a long freaking slog. And if you try to sprint and sprint, because why do people sprint? To get to the outcome faster. The problem is if you hate the process and the outcome doesn't come faster, you will burn out and you'll quit, right? The biggest successes are based on consistency, and the way to stay consistent is to love the process. And if you love the process, the outcome will come. You might get lucky and the outcome may come sooner, but if you keep sprinting, there's no guarantee that you won't burn out before the outcome comes. So I talk a lot about that on the Instagram, Lloyd Lobo.
Awesome. Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes, as well as to where folks can pick up a copy of your book. Lloyd, thanks again, man. This was a great conversation. We're going to have you back on again soon.
Hey, thanks, man. This was really good. And that's why I don't prepare for anything. I'm like, let's talk about anything you guys.
Let's go. Just rip.
Oh, Dubai. You know, if you all want to sponsor, just hit us up at the Sales Players, you know? All right. Awesome, we'll guys. Get seeing you. Guys. Take care, man.
Love and peace, brother. Take care.
Love and peace. See ya.